Thanks, Sally. I may, depending on how we go, I may add a slide or two. Is the next speaker actually here? Oh, I'm the next. I'm the next. So just a few quick kind of interesting factoids about impacts of stormwater, and if you're around this field or associated with it, these are probably not new to you. But a recent study has come out that said there's approximately 850 U.S. cities and municipalities that have either outdated or very under-designed stormwater management infrastructure. And not the only reason, but in large part because of that, according to the EPA, about three-quarters of Americans live near polluted water bodies. And there's another study that has said if we were to add up the total cost of what it takes, or what we pay annually as industry, as taxpayers, or society to clean up our polluted water bodies from poor stormwater management and our poor stormwater management infrastructure, we're paying about $44 billion per year. So what is green infrastructure? A lot of folks have maybe heard green infrastructure and stormwater management, or the term low-impact development, sustainable stormwater management, even maybe restoration hydrology. These are pretty fairly synonymous terms that a lot of folks really kind of use interchangeably. There's some subtle differences between each one of these, but for the most part, they're roughly the same thing. So I've tried to almost oversimplify what green infrastructure here in the graphic, but if you look at some of the color coordination, basically what happens as we develop our natural landscape systems and trade that for more of the built environment and really urbanization, you can see what happens is we're basically breaking or retarding the water cycle. Okay, so something that basically some folks will call our natural capital in the form of native plants, native vegetation, generally more biomass, organic matter, and native soils do a very, very effective, very efficient, and actually very free job of managing our stormwater and really site and watershed hydrology. What happens is, as we get rid of that, as we move towards more urbanization in the built environment, we have more and more impervious surface. And everybody knows the more impervious surface we have, the more surface runoff we have, the more surface runoff we have, the higher the pollutant loads. The higher the pollutant loads, the more polluted the water bodies are. Okay? So, in somewhat simplistic terms, what green infrastructure really tries to do is to take that natural capital that provides basically a free ecosystem service and put that into our urban environment. Okay, so as we move towards that urban environment, that free service of nature, we actually have to pay for more and more to keep our water clean or to clean up the water, okay, through water treatment facilities, wastewater treatment facilities, chemical treatment, storm inlets, combined sewer systems, all these things that cost cities and municipalities a whole lot of money, one of the big reasons why we have underdesigned stormwater management infrastructure in a lot of our cities. So in order to reduce the cost that we're all paying for this green infrastructure, we're trying to put green infrastructure more in our cities to reduce these costs and take more advantage of this free service. So, as I mentioned, green infrastructure and LID, or low-impact development, are fairly synonymous terms. You can see kind of their their strict definitions here. If you look at the slide, some folks have called green infrastructure EPA's low-impact development program, and in all honesty, it is. They've kind of coined the phrase and created a program around it. But no matter which one you kind of subscribe to or the term you like to use, really what they do is try to mimic the natural site hydrology, and it's a very decentralized, very distributed approach to stormwater management. Now, if you look at some of the bullet points in the slide here, these are some of the key objectives that these programs try to do on site when we develop a site. They try to significantly reduce the site runoff volume. They try to reduce peak runoff flow rates. They really try to eliminate as much as possible, or to reduce as much as possible, off-site stormwater discharges. And they try to use natural filtration mechanisms when stormwater does occur on the site to prevent, to really reduce pollutant loading, really from leaving the site and getting into storm drains and surface waters. So the result, obviously, reduced pollutant loading, reduced off-site flooding, increased water quality or adjacent water quality, improved or protected wildlife habitat and biological diversity, both on land and in water. And as some folks actually come at it for this last point, Some folks may consider it a byproduct, but it also tends to improve land aesthetics, and that in general increases land value as well. And we're actually starting to see that quite a bit in some new studies where the market is actually rewarding green infrastructure and low impact development on sites and development areas. There's actually a lot of specifications, or a lot of agencies, I should say, that have specifications for compost use in these applications. This is an example of the US EPA's specifications for compost blanket use, which is really an erosion control or slope stabilization application. The US Army Corps of Engineers has specifications. The USDA NRCS has specifications. The American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials has specifications. Really, almost every state DOT and state Environmental Protection Agency or department equivalent has their own specifications. Sounds pretty confusing, but the good news is that they're all pretty much the same, and they're all mostly built off the same body of research. Now, I'm not going to go through each one of these detailed parameters with you, but there's basically two main objectives that these specs are really trying to do. Number one is they're trying to ensure that we're using high-quality compost, okay? So if you look at really all but one of these parameters, they're really based around trying to make sure that you're using a well-composted, biologically stable, mature compost. And in that vein, it should be, for the most part, good for general use applications, okay? And in the composting industry, we would consider this to be generally mature compost. The other key parameter here, and this is what is different for these applications than most other types of compost applications, like for garden applications, agriculture, is the particle size distribution. If you look at the middle there, it's probably a little confusing looking at the different screen sizes or sieve sizes there. But the type of compost that we're using is generally coarser than the average type compost that most folks are using. In fact, there's two types of composts that we're using in these applications. This gives you a little bit better visual representation of what they look like. And both of them are quite a bit coarser than the compost that most of us are used to purchasing or using in our garden. Number one is actually a very coarse type media. It's what we generally call a filtration type media or a biofiltration type media. Sounds kind of funny, but a fair amount of research has gone on to try to create the optimum particle size specification for these applications to allow for runoff and stormwater to pass through this type of media, but to trap sediment and soluble stormwater pollutants at the same time. Just like a true filter, really. The other is what we'd call a growing media, or in some cases an erosion control type media. It's really designed, you can see it's also significantly coarser than most types of composts. It's designed for water absorption. It's also designed to reduce runoff flow rates once runoff does occur, and obviously also for plant growth. So anywhere where you're trying to use these for permanent vegetation establishment, generally you're going to choose the one on the right, and wherever you have a filtration type application, you'll choose the coarser one. These two types of compost have actually been used in quite a few different stormwater best management practice applications, and I've listed 24 different ones here. And if you look at really I have two columns here. The one on the left is construction activity stormwater management, and the column on the right is post-construction stormwater management. So you can see there's quite a few different applications here. They all use compost, either in whole or in part. Okay, from perimeter control of sediment to an erosion control blanket to a bioswale used as part of a mix in a green roof system, a bioretention system, biofiltration systems, engineered soil mixes, lots of different applications. You can really think about most of these in two kind of broad ranging categories, and one is the filtration type application where you can either use it in a containment system like I have pictures of here, or in a loose application which we'd call a compost filter berm. This would be a compost filter sock application for most of these. But you can see where it's being used for sediment control on a construction site, used to filter stormwater pollutants before it enters a storm drain, and even as a biofilter used in combination with vegetation in the bottom right. It's filtering pollutants from a big box store parking lot. So the next few slides I'm going to show you is more of a kind of a literature review or research review of some of the more recent research surrounding these applications. But this is a study that was done at the University of Georgia. It's published in the Journal of Soil and Water Conservation that looked at suspended solids removal for the compost filter sock application compared to just a wood chip mulch berm and a straw bale. This is one of the first studies that was done to really comparatively evaluate these compost biofilters compared to other types of sediment barriers that are often used on construction sites. San Diego State University did a study also looking at the compost filter sock management practice compared to a silt fence, which is obviously probably the most widely used sediment barrier on construction sites today, and then a straw wattle, which is used quite a bit, I think, on the West Coast, California. The USDA ARS wanted to look at this a little bit further, not really just evaluate sediment, but also wanted to see how they could, this type of application could be used as a true biofilter, so to be able to filter soluble stormwater pollutants. And really what you're seeing here, they looked at not only suspended solids and turbidity, but also total nitrogen, ammonium and nitrate nitrogen, total and soluble phosphorus, total coliform and E. coli bacteria. They looked at a few heavy metals, cadmium, chromium, nickel, lead, and zinc, motor oil, and diesel fuel. So looking at typical concentrations that you may see in urban runoff coming from a parking lot or a roadway, and how well this biofilter could filter it. So these percentages are basically removal efficiencies for one pass through the biofilter. Okay. The city of Chattanooga has actually implemented this as a best management practice to use for their municipal stormwater permits, their MS4 permits, municipal separate storm sewer systems. And that came about because back previous to February of 2007, you can see an aerial photograph there of about a 5.5-acre parking lot where they store and service most of their city vehicles. And they were out of compliance with their stormwater permit for chemical oxygen demand, suspended solids, and oil and grease. And so they put in one of these compost-based biofilters. It's really a combination of vegetation and a baffle, which you can see in the right-hand photograph there. I think you can barely make out the storm outfall and then the fence line where the stormwater leaves the property. So they came in and put one of these biofilters in and immediately got back into compliance at the next stormwater sampling interval. And they've actually only have to July 2009 here, but they've stayed in compliance to this date and continue to use this system. And you can see in red here kind of the range of percent reduction that they found using the system for the three pollutants they were out of compliance with. So the other broad application is really what I consider loose compost. Okay, so it's either applied what we call as a blanket to the soil surface, to a bare soil surface, inch or 2 inches thick, or we may mix it into the existing soil, or we may blend it with other materials. Okay, so could be soil, could be aggregates, could be other engineered media to make a rain garden or a bioretention or a green roof system. So you see some of the examples here from slope stabilization to actually reducing runoff going into a pond, green roof application, and a rain garden application. One study that was done in North Georgia looked at a compost blanket, and really a lot of the early research evaluating compost blankets was done for erosion control, to evaluate it as an erosion control practice, okay, compared to we've seen hydro seed, hydro mulch, straw mulch, and even rolled erosion control products. This particular study looked at the rainfall absorption characteristics of the compost blanket and found from a 4-inch rain event, it absorbed about 84% of the total rainfall. Now, this is probably the first study that let us know, okay, these tools are, there's a couple things going on here. These tools, possibly the reason why they're working so well for erosion control is because they're absorbing so much rainfall, thereby reducing runoff. But then it started to make us think, okay, well, there's probably applications for compost like this outside of just erosion control. And if you think about it, if it can absorb 84% of the rainfall in a pretty large storm event, and pretty intense storm event, for that matter, for probably 95% of the storms, depending on where you are, it's going to absorb all or nearly all that rainfall. So if you're absorbing all the rainfall, you don't have any runoff. If you don't have any runoff, you don't have any transport of pollutants. There's no transport of pollutants, nothing gets into a storm drain or gets into a water body. So this is really low-impact development to the extreme, if you think about it. Okay, so where low-impact development and green infrastructure tries to keep the stormwater on site, in some respects to try to get off the stormwater grid, compost blankets actually keep the rainfall exactly where it falls. Okay, so folks are actually able to use this type of application to reduce their stormwater containment systems, to reduce their pond sizes, to reduce bioretention systems, and actually do have other uses for that real estate in an urban environment, which can be pretty critical, particularly in today's economic environment. This is four different studies that looked at the runoff volume reduction comparing a compost blanket to basically a bare soil condition. Two from the University of Georgia, one from University of Connecticut, and the last one's from Iowa State University. So ranging between nearly 50% and about 90%. Similarly for peak flow rates, approximately 36% to nearly 80% peak flow rate reduction. I think one of the most interesting things that we've seen in the literature is how compost blankets have the ability to reduce nutrient loading, particularly compared to conventional seeding or conventional vegetation establishment practices. So I have four studies here. You see the references on the left. They're coming from Texas A&M University, two from the University of Georgia, and Iowa State University again. So the values you're looking at are the percent reduction in pollutant load identified going across the top compared to the vegetation establishment practice I have in parentheses. So seed and fertilizer, hydromulch, and seed and topsoil. Okay. Somewhat consistent numbers in percentage-wise across all these studies, and we've actually seen this in some other studies as well. and there's two main reasons why we're seeing this. Number one is the immense ability of the compost blankets to act like a sponge, absorbing rainfall, reducing runoff. Anytime you reduce runoff volume, you're also reducing the pollutant load. In some cases, there may actually be more nutrients being put down on these sites with the compost blankets, but because they're reducing so much rainfall or so much runoff, the pollutant loading is much, much less. And there's another caveat here, too, or another reason why this is happening, and this comes into play why it's so important to use high-quality compost, like I mentioned in the specification earlier. And that is, during the composting process, the nutrients become stable. In a process that happens, they generally move from being inorganic to organic in form. And during a runoff situation, organic nutrients are much less likely to be transported or become mobile in runoff compared to inorganic nutrients like we typically see in fertilizer applications. And we're actually seeing that as well in these studies. That was the last slide I have, but if there's time, I'll throw in another one. Unless there's any questions up so far. I'll show you one. Yeah.
In most of these studies with the compost, of course, when you have fresh material, it's very absorbent and things like that, but with time, especially in high temperature, the hydrophobic nature and stuff like that. When was all this data taken? On aged compost covers or young ones, so to speak?
It's a good question. We have seen in certain situations where if the compost gets really dry, it can become hydrophobic. We don't see it too much in the east. See it sometimes, in the arid parts in the west. I don't know what the exact percentage is, probably like below 20%, 15%, something like that, moisture, and then it begins to wick it a little bit, and then it takes a little bit of time for it to come back, but we do see that over time. As well, also what we'll see is sometimes folks, ask about the organic matter content and diminishing organic matter content over time, and because these are generally permanent vegetation establishment practices, as long as you're keeping the vegetation on site, not harvesting it like you would in an agricultural operation, you're gonna maintain the organic matter level.
I'm just curious about Chattanooga. Are they
Great question. They do compost. They're in a private-public partnership, and they are composting their yard debris and their leaves, and they did use that material, which is another great part of that story. They have yet, what are we, about 4.5 years in on that project? They haven't changed it out yet, but they're probably getting close. So they do monitor it quarterly, and I think it's probably getting close. And I don't know that it's... I'm actually going to go up there to oversee it soon, and I don't know if it's because they're starting to get to a breakthrough period with some of the nutrients, or it's getting inundated with sediment coming off the parking lot. It's probably some of both. Yeah, that's a really good question too. It really depends on what you're comparing it to, because there's a lot of different types of technologies out there, both in temporary stormwater management and permanent. In terms of permanent, what we're actually seeing is a lot of the highly engineered systems, active treatment system type technologies are very expensive, and I couldn't even put a dollar on it actually, but they're really quite expensive. Sometimes you lease them or rent them because they're so expensive. They're also energy intensive often, and chemical intensive, where they may be effective at reducing concentrations of pollutants to a certain amount, it's really hard to get large stormwater flows through those systems as well. So these passive type systems are getting a lot of attention from the EPA, and they're actually promoting them quite a bit in their green infrastructure type applications. He was asking if do we recycle the bags, or are the bags recycled? The bags, that netting is sometimes they use biodegradable material to do it, or all natural, actually compostable material. So I think there's an option for a cotton type netting. So you could, you know, if you want to leave it in the field, you could. There's different types of biodegradable netting, which is another whole issue and story that we won't get into. And then there's photodegradable types as well that are meant to be permanent and last. And as long as the vegetation is establishing well, you're basically blocking the UV, and that system will stay in. For the temporary applications, you can, if you use some of the photodegradable, a lot of folks will just cut the bag open and extract that and then get rid of that. And it'd be preferable if you could, you know, recycle the whole thing, of course, or apply, keep it all there. But if you're comparing it to other types of technologies, you've reduced your waste by 95% of what you might have to take to a landfill. Any other questions? Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.